Well, thank you so much. I've been really lucky to be able to engage with the Cancer Journals Revisited and before today, and the film and the work that it's doing have really changed my thinking about a lot of things. So thank you, and I want to make sure, actually, in a way that we just all get to participate in a conversation. But it is nice sometimes to have a structure for that. So the thing that came to mind, and it's an idea that I've been playing with, it's a little gimmicky, so please forgive me, but it works, I think, which is that the film enacts a poetics and politics of what I might call discogitation, to discogitate. And I have sort of a few different things that I think that term helps us refer to, all of which belong together as we try to enact a, let's say, a kind of we subjectivity that also centers bodies that are, as you say, as you said at the end of your comments, sort of non-normative outsider bodies. Just to the sort of meanings of discogitation for me are about unthinking. So, and we might even use like the cogito, right? So unthinking, the transcendent human unity. And I have questions attached to each of these. The second meaning would be to discogitate would be to feel the encounter with the other. So rather than relying on story and plot, the kind of affective intensification that's enacted in the film. The third is to think disability or to center disability. So there's a disability studies scholar, Anna Patsavas, who calls this a crepistemology of again, a collective we. And then the final would be dis, like as in dissing, as in thinking really disrespectfully about not just story, but it the sort of racist, heteropatriarchal history, so the kind of defiance that a film like this acts. So related to the first one, which is unthinking singularity, but also the way that the transcendent unified I is the center of most story, and I'm thinking here of the hero's journey. I was wondering if there are any other forms that you found yourself, form becomes kind of our friend and our enemy, so the Renga becomes an important form in the way that poetics always require some form. And so I was wondering if there were things that you thought of yourself as working with and against, besides the ones that we've already talked about, are the sort of most, the most obvious.
Well, I mean, Audre Lorde is working against the form of the memoir. So, I mean, I do think of this as a kind of, well, it's clearly her memoir, but it's also a kind of autoethnography of myself through these collective, it's an autoethnography of myself through other people and through Lorde. So, and thinking about Lorde already sort of radicalizing the notion of memoir in this piece in the Cancer Journals, which is, consists of poetry and journal entries, but also full-out expository essays. But she also had previously radicalized the autobiography in her in Zami, which she names a biomythography. And so I thought that was really interesting. That I could think of the Cancer Journals Revisited as a kind of biomythography or a kind of looking back at and against this kind of the construction of what is it a construction that the autobiography isn't constructing. Is it constructing a kind of mythic self or mythic selves? That's one.
Yeah, no, that's really helpful.
We had a very small email exchange, and you told me you were participating in a speculative memoir workshop, and I thought that's a good term also. That's an interesting, maybe this is a kind of speculative memoir.
Well, yeah, and I've been in a workshop this spring doing speculative memoir, and what's really striking about these workshop spaces is that it's actually the practice of writing them. So you don't come to it necessarily with story. It's the exercises you do. So you'll say, okay, what's one of the stories that you just can't get over? Okay, now write a totally different ending. And so it's the practice of doing it that creates it, rather than having some pre-extant sense of what that speculation will be. And it seems to also rely on this group interaction, because, you know, when you're speculating, it really helps to have other people's wild ideas. The way that you're working with Lord's radical notions. I'll just go to the second one, and then we can like see if other folks have things to contribute. This was about sort of affective intensification. I get really excited about this because it's a problem that's troubling me, which is the binary thinking about challenging embodiments. And so one hand, we have scholars who argue that profound bodily states exist prior to or in a destructive relationship with language. And so this is folks like Elaine Scarry, but also Virginia Woolf in On Being Ill. But then on the other hand is the belief that the ability to cast the body into story is essential for those who experience disability, illness, pain, and trauma. This is maybe more culturally pervasive. In the former approach, the focus of the critic or the artist turns to the ethics of witnessing. So knowing we cannot know the pain of another, what's the status of our account of human suffering? In the second, narrative takes on a kind of instrumentality beyond itself. Questions revolve around what a story does, either for the individuals or communities. I think of an example here, and I like this example, I don't mean it as a dismissal, but Anatole Breuillard in his Intoxicated by My Illness, this is a quote. The patient has to start by treating his illness not as a disaster, an occasion for depression or panic, but as a narrative, a story. Stories are antibodies against illness and pain. To die is to be no longer human, to be dehumanized. And I think that language, speech, stories, and narratives are the most effective ways to keep our humanity alive. And that really characterizes a lot of illness narrative right now, I would say, both as a genre and as a kind of means of production. Like, tell your story, and then you will feel better. But your film seems to me more aligned with this approach that I think gets us out of a kind of strange agon between the sick body and story, because the focus on the poetic reminds us that language is not equal to story. That was like a huge revelation that came to me, a ton of bricks watching this, is that language has these capacities to create feelingful resonance, that trouble, that soothe, create intensified affects. And here we talked a little bit about Christina Crosby, who has a book called The Body Undone. And she says, this is also a quote, even the most accomplished cripple you can imagine is undone, and living some part of her life in another dimension, under a different dispensation than realist representation. So her assertions about the limits of realism is an invitation, I think, to genre experimentation and anti-narrative, and cautions about the dangers of narrativizing away bodily experiences, even if it's supposed to be therapeutic, for which narrative conventions really are inadequate, though language itself may not be, because if we retain the promise, the potential, possibility made real of the poetic function, then we don't have to worry so much about, right, like, what is this really telling the story of some sort of deep internal state, because we're looking at what in the manifesto is called felt time, or that you referred to, this idea of felt time. So I thought maybe I would just ask you to talk a little bit more about felt time in the production of the film, the world-making process, the way that, you know, how resonances arose. I'm thinking of, you know, the beautiful shots that move between sort of urban and non-urban landscape, you know, how you experienced those and created those moments of intensification. Does that make sense as a question?
Yeah, it's just such a big question. I'm not going to be able to do justice to it. I mean, when you signaled what this question would be, I wasn't thinking at all about those shots, which is why I'm a little bit like, I was thinking of the, so we can talk about felt time in lots of different ways, and yeah. I'm sure most of the people here who are practitioners, who most of you are, I think editing is almost nothing but grappling with felt time. I mean, it is making and feeling time. But I guess I wanted to think about the moment of production as a moment of felt time. So for me, what came to my mind was psychoanalysis, which is not so surprising because I come from a number of years of training as a psychoanalyst, and I've been thinking within a psychoanalytic framework for a little while. But this psychoanalytic encounter has a great affinity for me with the encounter between a filmmaker and a participant. So I think of it as a shared felt time with that person that I've invited to give something of themselves to me. And so in terms of like collecting affect and also of discogitating, you know, because the psychoanalyst is not necessarily and not supposed to be thinking about what the person is saying. They're receiving it. And so this is a form of unthinking in some ways that you were talking about. I don't know.
That's really helpful. I love that way of thinking about editing.
Oh yeah, and editing, I mean, it's a whole, and when you talk about these moments of the exterior shots, I mean, then I just think, yeah, it's funny what editing can do, because those were shot like well before any of the readers were. Like the summer before I started the production of like going out and actually sitting with people and having them read to me, I went around New York City and shot all this film that I had been storing in my fridge for decades. So that kind of constructed time, it's a feeling time that's beyond historical time in some way, or it is historical time, but it's not chronological. Because we all do it in the editing room is just sort of create another kind of temporality.
You did something at the beginning of your presentation where you read a quote and then you put the quote up on the projection and then you said what comes next, and the projection had the part of it that comes next. And somehow I experienced that as similarly to how I experienced in your film when the person was reading the quote from Audre Lorde and then they went into talking about their own experience. And I just really liked both of those experiences, and I think I'm curious about other ideas that you have for creating that. I mean, because that's like a productive disjuncture, and I was just curious about other ideas you have for making that feeling happen.
Well, first of all, thank you, because that was a mistake here.
Oh, it was great.
Because I was like, oh, wait, this is the next slide. But in my editing, it's usually a conscious thing that I'm very interested in disjunctions and not entirely just slippages or I do think that when when you make something obvious, like when you point it, when you say something and you have it seen simultaneously, you're not engaging the viewer maybe you're engaging the viewer more in a participatory way when you make things a little bit less one-to-one. And I guess I feel like I do that with every cut, so I can't really point to a single point, but I try to at least. So it's a question of how much is too much, I guess.
Hi there. I'm a social worker in Quebec, in Canada, and I work in a women's center where it's very variable what can happen every day. And it has happened to me to speak to people who are dealing with cancer, women, and this film is very useful in a real-world perspective of on the ground, So I think it's going to really help me listen in a different way, and it spoke to me so directly about that cancer is just one of her problems. So, thank you.
Thank you so much. I am overwhelmed with thoughts and questions, but I have one, which is, what about the pronoun you?
I'm sorry, I think I neglected that in the lecture, but I definitely think the you is bound up in the entire project. I hope I'm making it for you as well as for me.
There's also something like playing with autoethnography. I've thought a lot about that the you in ethnographic practice is very important, because actually most of how, for instance, I hear stories is directed at me. So I'm going to tell you a story. And so I find when I write, for instance, I write a lot in the second person, because that's my internalized sense of, it's always an interactive you. So there's a way in which you is both like hailing the listener, but also reminding us that these speech acts are non-unitary, that they happen in relation, that they're deeply social. So I think second person is super interesting in that way.
And that reminds me that Paige, you wrote a great article that I will have to revisit now about this kind of dialectic encounter and in the interviewing format. So we will all have to go and look at that again. Yes. I do think now I have to return to her, but I do think it's just the passage that I pulled out that was circulating around I and we, and that it was noticeable that she had made this change. But elsewhere, she definitely writes, and elsewhere in the cancer journals, she writes to a you. It's so specifically addressed to an audience. The Transformation of Language into Science and Action was a lecture. It wasn't a piece of writing before. It was given in that space that I use the archival sound. That's why I use the archival sound at the beginning, because it is her voice, and it has the presence of the audit or of the conference room. Thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you.